In April of 1994, Hutu extremists in Rwanda began massacring Tutsis and moderate Hutus. In 100 days, more than 800,000 were killed, and the international community refused to intervene. Why did neighbors start killing each other? How can it be prevented in the future? And what should be the role of the international community in future cases of genocide? Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Vincent McCoury. 30 years after the Rwanda genocide, survivors continue to grapple with the fear and trauma. Their plight, they say, is exacerbated by ongoing battles against misinformation and genocide denial, prompting calls for increased education and awareness to foster a genocide-free world. Senanu Todd reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
Patrick Sidikubwabo was only 4 years old when his father and three siblings were killed during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. 30 years on, he says the memory still haunts him and is part of his story he can never forget. Another survivor, Jean-Claude Mugabe, was 9 when his father and uncles had to flee their house, leaving women and children behind. He says his relatives sought refuge in the village church, but were found and many of them killed.
I lost many siblings, you know, close relatives, such as aunt, uncles, cousins, you know. If I count it very well, they reached to 65 people. My uncle, the brother of my mom, he died with her wife and his whole children. So the family finished.
So this is me. Mugabe later found his little sister and father had been murdered.
Uh-huh. I participate, you know, in burying his remain. The only thing I could remember is his jackets, you know. Others were remain.
During a 100-day period in 1994, Rwanda's Hutu majority killed more than 800,000 minority Tutsis and Hutu moderates. The genocide in Rwanda was sparked by hate speech, mostly over the radio, by Hutu extremists against Tutsis. Mugabe says many survivors were traumatized, grieved, and radicalized. And at his age, he did not understand why his father had to be killed.
And sometimes I can say, if I can see the killer of my father, so I will do that. I will revenge as well.
The Aegis Trust, a non-profit dedicated to genocide prevention, has been running genocide memorial centers across the country, with the goal of helping people heal and learn about genocide prevention.
We do it through peace education program by understanding the past, but also building up the skills and the values that helps people to be able to develop critical thinking, the empathy, personal responsibility.
Mugabe has been part of the program and says it's helped him heal. He has even met with some of his father's killers and forgiven them.
I understood better and more better when I worked the memorial, and I started also supporting others from my community and my colleagues who have not yet moved forward.
UNESCO cites a lack of education as one of the causes of genocide, saying people turned against each other through misinformation. They have moved to recognize 4 memorial sites in Rwanda as World Heritage Sites.
The sites have to be preserved because what happened here matters for all humanity. It's a stain on the universal conscience, and we have to preserve the sites so first as to fight against distortion or denial of history.
Rwanda is marking the anniversary of the genocide against Tutsis with 100 days of remembrance. During this period, survivors are calling for more education and awareness to help combat genocide denial and misinformation, part of their healing journey. Senanu Todd, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Well, with us to talk about her personal story surviving the Rwanda genocide is Consolée Nshimwe. She joins us from New York. Consolée is also the author of Tested to the Limit, a genocide survivor's story of pain, resilience, and hope. Consolée, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's been 30 years, and for most, it's a terrible thing that happened in Rwanda. That's the genocide. For you, it is personal. If you don't mind, can you share briefly what you went through?
Thank you so much. Even though it's been 30 years, as a survivor, you still live with the memories of what you have gone through during that period. So when the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi happened, I was a young teenager, I was 14 years old. And during that period, in 3 months, I faced unimaginable horrors where I had to be hiding for 3 months. And during the period of 3 months, I lost my dad. My dad was murdered, and my three younger brothers were murdered. So they were young. They were 9 years old, 7 years old, and 16 months old. So, and during that period, rape was used as a weapon to many women and girls. And unfortunately, that happened to me too. So that was one of the painful things I had to go through during the genocide, and was raped. And as a result, I've been living with HIV. And these are the most horrible things that I have gone through at a young age. As a survivor, you live with these memories.
It's really hard even to imagine how somebody can survive that. Now, you put all that in a book that we just mentioned. For you, please share with us over those years, what does that mean to you? Why was it important for you to put it in a book? Why have you continued to tell your story?
Throughout the years, as a young person, I lived with trauma, with everything that I've gone through. But because of therapy, I started journaling everything that I've gone through. And it got to a point where I decided to write in my book. So that the world can learn what we have gone through. And for me, when I wrote my book, it was also therapy, because I had to go deep within of everything that I've gone through. But at the same time, it was a way of educating the world of what happened so that it won't be forgotten. So I that's the reason why I decided to write my book.
It's good to hear that you've been healing along the way. Now, 30 years later, what would you want to see in Rwanda, especially to ensure that there can never be anything that can lead to the hatred that triggered the genocide that happened in 1994?
I would like to encourage young people, especially young people, to continue educating themselves about what happened, and to preserve the memory of what happened during the genocide, so that the world, for themselves to make sure that it won't happen again, and also to continue educating the world. So for me, and helping themselves to become a better version of themselves.
And good to see you looking exactly as I saw you looking 9 years ago. So what's in terms of your own healing, where would you say you are today?
I would love to say that throughout the journey of telling my story, I have been able to learn how to appreciate life. And I'm truly grateful that I took this journey of healing. That's why I always encourage fellow survivors or anyone else who have gone through a painful experience, that you need to face it and go deep within, because when you take care of yourself, you are able to live a healthy and fulfilling life. And I'm grateful for what I've done, and I'm grateful to be alive.
Well, sure. Yeah. Consoli, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. We wish you a great, great life ahead, and the very best in your journey. Well, that Consoli Nshimwe is a genocide survivor, Rwanda genocide survivor. She joined us live via Skype from New York. Now joining us from Nashville, Tennessee, is Claude Gatebuka. was 10 years old at the time of the genocide. Claude is now the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network and is also the co-author of a book about his experience titled Survivors Uncensored, 100 plus testimonies from survivors of the Rwandan genocide, as well as a pre- and post-genocide Rwanda, inspiring stories of resilience and humanity. Claude, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Vincent. Thank you for having me.
Yes, now it's a 30-year anniversary. You were a young man then. You are no longer that young. But just share with us your recollection and what you had to go through at that tender age in your life.
What started when I was 10 years old is actually a war in Rwanda that started in 1990 that culminated in the genocide. I was actually same age as Consolé, 14, when the genocide started with the shooting of the president, the Rwandan and Burundian presidents in Rwanda. And my recollection during the genocide was the night when the plane shooting happened, we heard a lot of explosions. I was in the city of Kigali, and people were screaming for help. Animals, dogs were barking. Cows were making, all kinds of animals were making noise and things. It just sounded like everything was crumbling around me. And then the next day, mobs of extremist Hutus started going house to house, killing Tutsis. At the time, it was just me and my mother and my two sisters. My father was actually in the U.S. When a genocide happened. And we went into hiding. We eventually took shelter with some neighbors. But at night, we would hear people coming into our house searching for us when we were still in hiding in the storage shed at our house. Then when we got to the neighbors, the shootings and the bombings continued. And of course, during that period, the RPF was also bombing everything in front of them. Mm-hmm. The bombing got so intense that we had to flee the city of Kigali. As we fled the city of Kigali, we kept getting stopped. And at every checkpoint, somebody would intervene to stop us from getting killed. At one of the stops, we were made, they pulled me and my mother out. They didn't actually pull out everybody at that time. They mm-hmm. pulled me and my mother out. The order, a man looked me in the eyes and said, "Say goodbye to life."
Yeah.
And they took us away from the street. And once they were getting ready to kill us, a large group of people, local people that I would never recognize if I saw them the next day, came and they started yelling and saying, "Hey, stop killing these people! Do not kill them!" And the guys looked at us and said, "Go to those guys, borrow some shovels and hoes, and dig your grave, because we've got to bury you after we kill you.
And you survived, and what an harrowing experience it was. But it's been many years now. You've actually written books. You've continued telling the story. Why is that important to you? And 30 years later, how significant is the anniversary to you?
I think it's extremely important. Our book, I co-authored it with actually seven other survivors. And we shared over 100 accounts of people surviving the Rwandan genocide, but also the atrocities that took place leading up to the genocide, where people were getting called to meetings in the hundreds and being surrounded by RPF troops and grenades thrown into the crowds and people getting killed with hand weapons. It was important for me it's been therapy, as Consolé said, to actually share my story publicly. And so it was important for me to also, in this book, Survivors Uncensored, to share the stage with other survivors who have not been able to share those stories so that they also can experience the therapy. It's also important in preventing future atrocities and genocides, because a lot of times what happens is the perpetrators bank on everything they do staying in the dark and staying in the dark forever. And they will go as far as possible, including murdering the witnesses and anyone that speaks up on it. But the more the people speak, first of all, they heal. Secondly, the perpetrators know that they cannot hide behind the darkness that continues to shelter them.
Now, we know that during the anniversary is a very sobering moment, and some sometimes say, well, this comes around every April 7th, every April. But what lessons have been learned or should be learned within Rwanda without pointing fingers on how the country can move forward together and also how this can never happen again or should never happen again?
The lessons learned are that with time, everything comes to light. And as everything comes to light, it's important to allow every person, regardless of, you know, so in this genocide, as the report rightly said, Tutsis were murdered, Hutus were murdered, Twas were murdered, non-Rwandans were murdered. All of those stories must emerge. And it also has to show, the stories have to be very authentic in order for people not only to heal, because when people speak, they actually do heal. Secondly, to set the record straight. And as the record is set straight, that's actually part of transitional justice and restorative justice. People are restored, they heal through therapy. And then eventually, there has to be justice. When there is justice, people know that they can move forward and that such atrocities, no one can ever get away with committing such atrocities when justice happens. So we have to continue not only to shed light on everything that happened, to make sure that everyone is aware, and also to continue the pursuit of justice to ensure that nobody ever thinks that they can do something like this and get away with it forever. And it starts with shining light on it.
Indeed, what a lesson to the whole world, indeed. Thank you, Claude, for sharing your insight. Claude Gatebuka, Rwanda genocide survivor and executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Now let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what history and politics has taught us about genocide. What are the conditions on the ground that make it possible, and what is or should be the role of the international community? We'll be right back.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. 30 years have passed since the Rwanda genocide, but wounds are still open. Let's take a look at which acts of aggression are considered genocide. Genocide is an internationally recognized crime where acts are committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. But what makes a group of people in the same country turn against its neighbors? To help us understand this better, We're joined by Scott Strauss, Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Strauss has written extensively on this subject matter. One of his books is The Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership and Genocide in Modern Africa. Professor Strauss, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is a subject you've studied for many, many, many years. What are those conditions that precipitate genocide or could potentially do?
I think the most important factor is generally armed conflict or some type of security emergency. That's number one. I think the second is that there's some type of exclusionary nationalist ideology that's well-rooted in the country. I'd say that's number two. And I think the third is some capacity to inflict violence over time and space. So that could be military force, state capacity, paramilitaries, militias, and that type of thing. And then lastly, the absence of restraint or the something that doesn't stop perpetrators from committing those kinds of atrocities.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of Rwanda, we know that there had been conditions, there have been fights in between the two ethnic groups over the years. How did that culminate into this explosion of 100 days of massacre?
And Rwanda was experiencing a major crisis in the 1990s. I think, as Claude mentioned, there was a civil war. There was the assassination of the president on April 6th, which was the trigger that really started the genocide. So there was an armed conflict. There was an emergency. There also was major political change in Rwanda. Rwanda was experiencing a transition from a one-party state to a multi-party environment, as many African countries were in the early 1990s. So the immediate context was one of great turmoil, of emergency, and so forth. Then, of course, there's a much longer history in Rwanda, and there's a history here of Hutu nationalism that goes back to the period of independence, which in turn builds on colonial policies that were kind of racist in origin and were built on exclusion of the Hutu majority in Rwanda. And so there's you know, a longer and deeper history that those who ultimately put the genocide in motion were drawing on when they committed it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your studies, actually, you've drawn comparisons also of countries where there were conflicts, but it did not lead to what is described as genocide. And some of those countries are like Cote d'Ivoire, there's Mali, there's Senegal in the past. You know, what is it that was different in those countries that, you know, prevented them from going that particular route?
Yeah, I think there are two big factors that we can point to. I think one is that in places like Senegal, places like Cote d'Ivoire and Mali, of course, not everything is perfect in these places, but that what I found is that the sort of leaders after independence or in the multi-party era built images of a multi-ethnic or multi-religious nation that was integral to their political vision of the country. And that multi-ethnic, multi-religious space was ultimately the main reason why these places did not go the direction of genocide, in contrast to a place like Rwanda, where the political trajectory was really built on Hutu nationalism, a kind of exclusionary nationalism. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, perhaps for me, the most important factor. I think the second are incentives for moderation. In a place like Cote d'Ivoire, you have a very strong economy built on agriculture, on cocoa and coffee production. There was kind of incentives to limit the violence there. In other places, you had international intervention, which can matter. So some kinds of restraint or some type of effort to get in the way of the escalation of violence.
Professor Strauss, there has been, of course, over the years, kind of a frustration, especially with how things happened in Rwanda and the international community. There was no response. Even when on the ground, there were reports from even those who were, you know, trying to help. And yet, nothing was done. So what's the difference between what happened in Rwanda, say, with what happened in Kosovo and the reaction and response we saw?
Yeah, I mean, Rwanda, I mean, it's so awful what happened in Rwanda. I mean, there's just no way around it. It was, you know, many people call it a preventable genocide in many respects. I mean, there was ample warning. You had a peacekeeping force on the ground. There was, I mean, the violence was extremely swift. It was extremely intense, but in many ways was committed with ordinary, you know, tools, with machetes, with other kinds of tools that people got in their home, as well as with grenades and with guns as well. But in the sense of being able to stop that, it would have been possible. You also had a force commander on the ground who wanted to act and was prevented from doing so, the Canadian general, Roméo Dallaire. So in many respects, it was a preventable genocide, and it was absolutely horrible that the world walked away from it. I think that there has been a lot of learning since Rwanda, and it's important to recognize that. I mean, Rwanda was really a low point, together with what happened in Bosnia a year later. And there has been a lot of learning in the international community. There have been better tools that have been built, better early warning systems, better peacekeeping operations, stronger use of sanctions and criminal justice mechanisms, and better policy and doctrine. So there has been a lot of learning in the last 25, 30 years. I think that, you know, to answer your question about Kosovo and Rwanda, I mean, of course, one dimension is Rwanda is in Africa, it's in Central Africa. There was not a lot of strategic interest on the part of world powers at the time. There was not a lot of attention on Rwanda. I mean, we know the story of Rwanda now, in part thanks to the kinds of survivors that you interviewed earlier. But at the time, it was not something that people were really aware of. I mean, I remember it being on the front pages of the newspapers, but it was called a tribal conflict. It wasn't called a genocide. And people dismissed it. They didn't understand what was going on very well. And that does point to an important role of the media. Go ahead.
Yes, and you know, you have a background in media yourself. Who failed? Is it those of us, like you and me, who were on the ground reporting, or was it the editors in the Western capitals who did not want to really see what's happening and tell the story?
There's a lot of blame to go around. I think, you know, certainly on the media side, I think the framing of the conflict at the time was really incorrect. It was framed as a tribal conflict, which suggests that people can't do anything. It's happened for centuries. These are age-old animosities. We know now that's completely wrong, right? This was a state-planned, state-organized, mass violence campaign of extermination, a genocide. So it was not tribal conflict run amok. That's number one, the framing of the media.
Okay, Professor Strauss, what has to happen? What must be done at the, you know, international level to make sure this never happens again anywhere?
I think people have to care. That's the number one thing. I mean, I think that there has to be attention. There has to be a spotlight, as people have said. I think there has to be political interest. There has to be political will. Politicians have to care. Then I think there has to be cooperation at the international level. You have to get, you know, the UN Security Council, folks of the African Union, regional organizations like ECOWAS or other regional organizations to prioritize this issue. If those things don't happen, there's not going to be any prevention of genocide in the future.
Well, we have to leave it right there. Professor Strauss, thank you very much for being on the show. Scott Strauss is a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks to our affiliate stations bringing you Straight Talk Africa across the continent. Thank you for joining us on TV, radio, and online. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.